Good day, I'm Anne Dolinchek, and you're listening to Coffee Conversations about Influencer Marketing. We're in conversation with Mike Stopforth in this episode. Mike is a well-known entrepreneur, startup investor, author, global speaker, and a disruption and innovation advisor on a number of corporate boards. In this episode, we discuss digital transformation and what it actually is and how influencer marketing fits into the equation. The reason for skepticism in our industry and why it's wrong. Most brands' lack of understanding of how influencer marketing contributes to sales and the trick brands are missing with their own customers and so much more. A quick thank you to this episode's sponsor, Coffee Monster. This app ensures that you get your coffee whether you're in a rush, in an afternoon slump, or simply need your caffeine fix on the go. It allows you to order and pay for your beverage from your favorite barista or discover a new spot in your area while collecting loyalty points across all stores. Location services will notify the barista when to have your beverage ready so that you can pick it up or have it delivered to your car or office in the blink of an eye. Download the app today from your app store. Good morning, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure most of our listeners already know who you are, but for the few that don't, can you please maybe give us an overview of who you are and just what do you do?
Sure, Anne. Thank you so much for having me on the show. We've been chatting about it for a couple of weeks. It's nice to bring it to life. I used to run a business called Cerebra, which is a social media agency in South Africa. And I ran that business for about 13 years and left the business at the end of 2018. I took 2019 off to do a master's degree, and that was a really great experience, and had these really big ideas for what I wanted to achieve in 2020, and then the apocalypse hit. So that was more of a chilled year than I expected. But most of my time has been taken up in consulting and doing a fair amount of public speaking, some facilitation and workshopping work with clients, but all around this notion of digital transformation, which is a topic that I'm really interested in, partly because it's quite close to my experience, but also because it seems to be broadly misunderstood and misused as an idea. So yeah, I'm all into trying to figure out the most practical and meaningful ways to engage with the topic, and that's been my preoccupation for the last while.
Amazing. And that's exactly why you are on the podcast today as well, to talk to us about this big thing called digital transformation. I myself aren't always sure if I am interpreting it correctly. So I thought, if I'm thinking that, most other people are thinking that, and who better to actually talk to us about it and also relate it to the influence marketing space than Mike Stopforth. So thank you for that. So what is it?
Yeah, so I mean, that's the question, right? Towards the latter sort of part of my journey at Cerebra, I started hearing that phrase used more and more, and it certainly wasn't the first time I'd heard a phrase adopted like that by the industry or by the media, and, you know, whether it's big data or social media before that or programmatic marketing or any of the things that become kind of part of the lexicon of what we do. There's always a mini red flag that pops up in my mind around, number one, what does this actually mean? And number two, are we all talking about the same thing? Because certainly in business, I would find myself having conversations around a boardroom table with clients where I was fairly convinced that everybody there had a different understanding of what we were talking about, depending on their own objectives when the topic of digital transformation came up. So yeah, I really wanted to sit back and understand what we really meant, and going into that process was even more disturbing, because almost every definition that I looked up for digital transformation was subtly different or sometimes substantially different. And added to that, when I was looking for really interesting case studies, I was only really finding examples of organizations that had their pedigree in digital already. So it had kind of been born in the internet era, if you like. And I looked at that and thought, well, no disrespect to businesses like Netflix, who have been able to demonstrate a remarkable ability to pivot and adapt in the digital era, but they were born in the digital era. Now, I imagine for them, it's slightly easier to do so with 5 or 10 years worth of legacy and muscle memory than it is for an organization like, let's say, Old Mutual or General Motors or, you know, somebody who's been around for decades, centuries in some cases. And I think what I wanted to understand more and more is that if there is something called digital transformation, if that is a quantifiable and real term, what is it? And then what are all the other things that brands could potentially do if for whatever reason they aren't able to transform? So this is a very long answer to your very short question. But where I arrived at was digital transformation is I guess, another way of us saying that we want to build organizations that are adaptable or able to adapt to any type of disruption that is spurred on by technology internally or externally. So when I say internally, I mean in terms of process optimization or staff dynamics or operations or finance, and externally in terms of the changing face of the customer, branding and marketing. And obviously, digital as a term is extremely broad. So it relates to technologies themselves. It relates to experiences and you know, kind of platforms that are only possible because of those technologies, but also very unique behaviors that spring out of the use of those things, the combination of those things together. So digital transformation is really an organization's ability to adapt in the face of radical digital disruption, or using digital tools to adapt in the face of radical market disruption. And if that's the case, then it sort of speaks to a very specific type of leadership and culture that is willing to take a long-term view and willing to be quite critical of past methods and approaches. And that's often what's missing when organizations try and digitally transform, is they do it in short-term projects. They assume that they can build or buy a piece of software that will automatically solve business problems, and those things don't seem to work. So it really is a long-term commitment on behalf of leadership to build the type of business that can adapt in the face of radical change. And if that is what digital transformation is, then I'm sure you'll understand there's a lot of businesses that are calling activities digital transformation that aren't really transformative as such.
Oh, that's so interesting, because to your point, I think everyone has a different definition depending on where their experience lies. And it became kind of a buzzword. So it really isn't just about implementing something for the next 3 months, but it needs to kind of be ingrained within the culture over time, which I think a lot of these old legacy companies, which are great, probably find really, really difficult to do.
Yeah, I think the key word there is transformation, less so digital. And the reason why I focus on transformation is that this is not the only context where we use that word. We use that word in relation to cultural transformation or economic transformation. And when we're talking about those concepts, the same rules apply. Organizations that treat these things as window dressing or as a tick on a compliance certificate or as a short-term initiative to please the market or shareholders inevitably find that they've not transformed. It's not something that has happened in a sustainable or meaningful or measurable way. If you really want to transform, we're talking about a quite radical reorienting of an organization in a new direction in order to maintain profitability, in order to maintain growth. Those things are critically important. It's not at the expense of those things. But if you want to, especially if we think about just how uncertain and unpredictable the world is right now, if we want to build organizations that will exist in the next 10 to 15 years, you have to be transformative. You can't think in the short term. So, you know, every self-respecting business person will say, yeah, sure, I want my business to be around forever. But we typically run organizations with very short-term mindsets and very short-term metrics. Mm-hmm. And that dichotomy, that paradox is, I think, where transformation in any context, whether it's digital or economic, kind of falls over.
No, for sure. So when we look specifically kind of at the marketing industry when it comes to this digital transformation, where was that big shift and what was it that everyone kind of started saying, well, we need to do this now, or we need to start doing this, because if we don't, we're kind of going to be left behind.
Yeah, so I think the digital marketing space has evolved predominantly in two ways, in my mind. So there are channels that we understood them to be traditional channels, walled gardens from each other, whether it was radio or television or outdoor or print, that have slowly but surely, as channels, independently from each other, digitized in some way, shape, or form. And as they've done so, there's been a degree of convergence. So if a radio show can be recorded digitally and distributed on a podcast, is it still radio, or is it now digital. You know, if a billboard mm-hmm. can show a video that was originally launched on YouTube, is that outdoor advertising or is that digital marketing? So there's the digitization of traditional channels has led to a kind of highly converged, what we call omni-channel marketing space. But I think that's less important and less difficult to understand and embrace than the shift in behavior around the customer, which definitely is more prevalent when it comes to your space around this notion of influencer marketing, which is what we've come to call it. And really another way of looking at influencer marketing is the most significant shift in marketing in the last 20 years is that customer markets, audiences went from being extremely passive receivers of information and content to being kind of simultaneous producers and consumers of content at the same time. And the social web gave us the opportunity to be publishers. And when I say us, I mean the ordinary customer, to be publishers for the first time ever. And that was pretty radical. I mean, people talk about that as being as big a shift for society as the printing press was when it was invented at the outset of the Industrial Revolution. And I'm a firm believer that giving the power of publishing to ordinary people, you know, if the printing press made the illiterate literate, then, you know, Facebook's and the Twitters and the YouTubes of the world made the unpublished published. That shift is the predominant reason behind why we see, you know, social media as being such a significant role player in politics and in culture today, and significantly from a business perspective in terms of how we think about branding and how we think about the engagement between brands and consumers. The mistake that we've made is that we've taken that ability of customers to build personal brands, build networks of influence, and we've tried to turn it into a traditional channel. So when I think of how most of my clients, or most of the clients I worked with in Cerebra, thought about influencers, they thought predominantly about how many followers do they have, predominantly a kind of a reach exposure mandate, and, you know, how can I compare that to other traditional channels, it's basically like a human billboard, right? And then I'll kind of calibrate my thinking around cost and around investment according to that. And that's a very one-dimensional way of thinking about that person's role in the mix. The problem is that influencers embraced that just as much as brands did and said, well, that's exactly how I'm going to act then. I'm going to act like a digital billboard. this sort of one-dimensional approach to this very exciting, I think, component of marketing became the sort of the predominant way of interacting, which is a bit of a shame.
So do you think influencers kind of started embracing that way of kind of putting their content out there because brands, that's what they were looking for? Or do you think it's the other way around?
I guess it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. But if we look back at Facebook's evolution as a platform and how powerful it was in terms of, you know, the very purest form of social networking and network effects mm-hmm. and the power of that organic content and letting things, letting the community decide what was important and unimportant content and all of the magic that comes with a truly organic social network that's digitized and, given exponential power. The trade-off was, how do we make money out of this? And instead of putting the onus or responsibility on the users to help fund the platform, the decision was made to favor critical mass and growth at all costs and to rather sell ads and to use customer data to make those ads more targeted so it could compete with more traditional mm-hmm. channels. And that's a real shame, again, because it just turns it into a very one-dimensional interaction. And that, I think, is what's happened in the influencer space. I don't know who's to blame, but I do think that it very quickly became the way of transacting. And you think of all the other possible ways that brands could embrace I just think of how many brands spend money on influencers that have a whole bunch of customers in their existing database, existing customers that have significant influence, maybe not at the same levels of reach, but certainly exceeding those big influences in terms of authenticity and meaningfulness that they're not even talking to, that they don't even know exist, customers that are part of their ecosystem that they haven't even begun to reach out to in a meaningful way. So that's a it should have been that influencer marketing had a closer relationship with CRM, or what we traditionally understood to be CRM, than it's had to do with advertising.
So I suppose then that kind of brings that nano influencer who's kind of already your brand fan versus your macro guys, and where the different types of guys fit in. Because I mean, absolutely, your brand fans are obviously your biggest influence because they speak to their networks on a daily basis. If someone wants to buy a new phone, they'll ask, hey guys, which phones, you know, do you recommend? Have you had a good experience? Which place, which brand? Versus where then do you use those macro guides? Is it then for purely that word of mouth reach effect and not really wanting people to take action, awareness? And then you use your brand fans more of those real influencers who's going to have a huge effect on their networks.
Well, I don't think it's an either or situation. I think it's possibly a both and. To borrow liberally from my friend and ex-business partner, Craig Rodney, he would talk about, you know, what do we really mean by influence? When we say influence, we mean the ability to impact behavior, to change behavior. That's not really what we're talking about when we talk about influencers. We're talking about having people see our stuff. You know, it should be called reach then. That's really, you know, influence is quite, we're talking about a level of intimacy and trust that's quite difficult to replicate in any other channel. Mm-hmm. So I, as you've rightly pointed out, I know that there are decisions that I'll make or people that I'll rely on to make decisions in my network that, you know, I don't necessarily need traditional marketing to endorse or support or justify. The challenge for brands is how do you find, connect with, and build relationships of trust with those individuals in a way that's scalable and meaningful. And as you rightly point out, it probably needs to be part of a broader ecosystem of activity. But the thing that blows my mind is just how many fans of organizations are there already, are out there, are people that are, have already of their own accord, without being paid anything, without being given a desk drop, without being sent free gifts, are already in love with the brand, already even over a couple of hundred people, but in some cases a couple of thousand people, exert significant influence over them and are just not being connected with. In a weird way, that actually has a worse impact because what happens is all your genuine fans get neglected in favor of people that really don't care about you or are willing to horse trade your brand's exposure for whoever's paying more money at that point in time. So it almost has a negative sort of counter effect.
No, absolutely. And I think probably bringing it back to that digital transformation or digital advancement, that's where brands really need to invest in those social media listening tools or AI to kind of find those guys. Because if you build that little army of brand fans, oh my gosh, you're unstoppable as a brand.
Yeah, so I think that's certainly one part of it, the role that technology plays. And obviously, I've got to be careful because we're talking about clients, like all clients are the same. And obviously, all clients have got very different challenges in terms of the size and diversity and demographics of their markets. But certainly for a lot of organizations that I've worked with over the last 6 months that have a lot of retailers that I've spoken to that have quite a quantifiable audience, an audience that they can to a greater or lesser degree segment and an archetype with, you know, with some intention, their lack of understanding into what component of that audience has some influence online is astounding. It's terrifying. And I think it's not that there aren't tools that allow them to do that, as you rightly pointed out. Really cool, you know, machine intelligence built into monitoring and listening tools. There's some fantastic and quite pricey platforms that allow us to do that. There's also some incredible CRM software that allows us to do that. What doesn't seem to be happening is the integration between those two worlds is connecting the user that has willingly, and so I'm not talking about like prying into people's personal data. I mean, people that are willingly and voluntarily offered their, I mean, I'm an example of that, right? I don't have significant influence online, but I'm fairly public and my name can be reconciled fairly simply with any account that I have with a bank or with an auto manufacturer or an insurer or whatever it might be. It shouldn't be that difficult in my mind to connect those two things together. But again, perhaps this is one of the tricks that was missed by social networks, because the ability for me to set up a completely anonymous profile that is in no way, shape or form connected to any social security or identity number means that brands can't really connect with social networks at scale using that kind of unique identifier. And again, it's, you know, if I had the ability to pay for a platform like Twitter to create an ad-free authenticated ID environment where I know that I can trust that the people who are commenting and adding content to that platform are doing so with a degree of accountability, and that brands could then offer that, or rather Twitter could then offer that to brands as a way to connect with me intentionally based on the data and analytics that I'm producing with all of that, you know, kind of content that I'm creating. That could be quite interesting. However, the counterbalance to that is, then would it be Twitter? Right? Would it be something
Absolutely.
Else? I completely understand that I'm dreaming of a utopia that possibly can't exist.
So maybe, Mike, you can build it for us one day. And then
you think
solution. So what do you think is the biggest challenges then, besides the ones we've obviously now discussed already, that brands face regarding influencer marketing and an extension that digital marketing component?
Yeah, so I think I can add to some of the points that we've brought up already around the fact that influencer marketing has kind of been bastardized into a sort of a glorified billboard sales and promotion industry. Some of the lack of integration between, you know, kind of internal CRM data and external marketing data. And I want to add maybe what I'm not seeing in, and this is a conversation I seem to be having with so many clients that are pouring enormous amounts of money into digitizing their marketing and advertising initiatives, is a lack of understanding of the decision-making process, the behavioral dynamics, for lack of a better phrase, the funnel that gets a given customer, existing or potential customer, to the point where they make a decision that justifies your spend. It's so many clients are spending a fortune on marketing, on advertising, on branding work in the digital space, and not understanding how that's contributing towards the moment they make a sale. And because there's very little connection between those two things, there's an enormous amount of skepticism that's risen around the effectiveness of this highly targeted and highly measurable space, which is a real shame, again, because it should, by all accounts, offer you a distinct advantage in terms of measurement and analysis. And I think there's a sense from customers that they're not getting that part from their agencies and consultants, is how directly is this tracking or translating to our ability to make a sale, our ability to convert. Now, some industries obviously are far more mature in this respect, and certainly, you know, kind of when you think of some of the financial services spaces. But I think, as an example, retail is just, there's a long way to go in terms of understanding this dynamic and getting a better sense of people's behaviors and how that leads to a converted opportunity. And then obviously there's lower volume subscription-based industries that I think are still learning a lot of these lessons. But there seems to me, in my perhaps naive stance on this, that there is very little reason not to know whether your marketing spend is working or not. And
absolutely.
Yeah, the question I keep asking my clients is, what is the question your customers are asking that only you can answer? What is the need that they have that only you can fulfill? And when is that need or that question being expressed? And are you there when that's happening? And how effectively are you moving them through that journey so that, you know, they get to, I mean, the number of experiences I've had as I've slowly but surely descended into the black hole of e-commerce over lockdown my old bones are slowly but surely becoming far more susceptible to the ploys of digital ads when it comes to, I'm like, oh, another sale. Okay, that must be for me.
You are not alone in that. I have also succumbed.
It's another plague. Yeah, me and online shopping. But the amount of times that I've clicked on an Instagram ad that has spoken directly to a need that I have at that point in time, because obviously these guys have some very clever ways of understanding what's interesting to us and what we care about at any given point in time. Click through and gone to a store or a storefront or even a website that doesn't have a store, and there's absolutely no way for me to complete a sale or to process. Nope. There's nothing that's tracked through from what I was looking at in, you know, kind of in Instagram or whatever it might be. And it's just, I imagine, you know, people that have spent an enormous amount of money on this on the other side are going, I just don't feel like it's working. I don't know how or why. And that seems a real shame to me. For all the opportunity, a lot of the execution is extremely poor. And I think there's a big gap there.
No, absolutely. And I think it also boils down to, like you were saying earlier, it comes down to those agency partners as well to actually educate and sit with their clients and actually find out what they want to kind of achieve with this campaign and then delve deeper and ask all those questions we just spoke about. And then with influencer marketing, we can target so specifically different audiences on your Instagrams, on your Twitters, on your Facebook. And like you say, you see something, you're like, oh yeah, I'm interested in that. And our ads is just so much more relatable because you use real people who's doing relatable, amazing things. And that should then, if you click on it, click through to something that that person can do or want to do or will fulfill their expectation. One of my biggest frustrations, and I'll tell you this, Mike, about, I think about 2 weeks ago, I was online, I was looking for something for my garden, I found it, and I was like, amazing, there's two websites, it looks amazing, and none of them had price lists on it. So then it was like, please email or phone us to get prices. And then I'm already out. I'm like, guys, I don't want you. To my demise, I emailed the wine guys and they were like, send us your phone number. I want to talk to you. And I was like, no, just give me prices. And then they were like, but, and it was just a whole spiel. At the end of the day, I never got the prices and I just went somewhere else. And I think it needs to be hand in hand. Can you deliver what you want to achieve through these campaigns? If not, then kind of get those building blocks right before you do more damage to your brand by all of a sudden skipping all these other steps and then go straight into something digital that you just can't deliver for your clients.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other universe to this thing is the reputational risk that comes with contracting with influencers who don't inherently understand your values as a business, the ins and outs of working with you, and we've seen just time and time again how that can go horribly pear-shaped and you know, produce a further kind of level of skepticism around the efficacy of the channel, which is a real shame, again, because when you and I talk about a brand of influencer marketing, that's not what we're talking about. So yeah, I think there's a lot of work there to be done. I think one of the big evolutions we're going to start to see over the next couple of years is this notion of values-based marketing, right? Where we start to think about how our brand's inherent identity, what it really stands for. And as we've seen more and more brands starting to market based on a stance rather than benefits or product features, you know, you think of the Patagonias and the Nikes and, you know, these Ben and Jerry's and, those are just some examples. But I think, more and more we're starting to see brands on all ends of the political spectrum creating a deep connection with, their clients because of their unique points of view on particularly interesting topics. So I think that's something that we're going to start seeing emerging. But yeah, I just think, I want to place more of the emphasis and responsibility on, we've spoken about the role that brands have and we've spoken about the role agencies have, but also just on the influencers themselves. Because the shortcut billboard approach to this work is not sustainable. And I hear a lot of influencers going, oh, this is not working for us. And this is, you know, this is just not how it should be. And I'm going, but how have you changed it? How have you initiated different kinds of relationships? How have you packaged yourself to focus more on, you know, kind of long-term trust-based relationships with your clients rather than billboard style exchanges. And I think there's a lot of work to be done in influencer circles, wherever those are, to change the temperature of the engagement between, you know, as I think we've seen a lot of maturity in the sponsorship space, in the sort of traditional sports sponsorship space in this regard, you know, in many ways inspired by and sparked by some leading organizations around the world, whether it's the IPL in India or, you know, some of the leading NFL and NBA brands, some of the leading football clubs. And we started to think very differently about that relationship and how to build integrity-based and, you know, values-based relationships with not only fans but brands as well, and just really look after that ecosystem. I think there's a lot to be learned from that, from an influencer perspective.
No, you're absolutely right. And you have absolutely hit it on the head. For me, it's also about influencers taking a lot of responsibility. If you are approached by a brand or an agency that has deemed you to have the perfect fit for this brand, and I think your values are amazing, but if you as an influencer feel that there's a conflict, it is on them to also decline those opportunities. So it's not just them kind of doing everything and for everyone, because at that point is where their trust and their credibility is eroded. And I feel like they need to start thinking about their influence, if that's the path they go down as a business, where you can't be everything to everyone, and choose those projects very wisely so that you are kind of recognizable or kind of connected to certain brands that really is good for your own brand and fits your values, but also vice versa. So it's really this complementary relationship that it's a win-win in the end of the day.
Yeah, I think you've said it better than I could have. No, definitely. This kind of disease around the pursuit of all opportunities. If you're trying to please everyone all of the time, or you're taking on everything, or you're trying to sound like everyone all of the time, you land up just with this kind of vanilla, meaningless, you know, kind of substanceless identity or presence. Maybe I'm being a bit harsh, but you know, it's interesting because there are many ways that digital has shown us, as when I say us, I mean the gen pop, right? Like the general population, to be quite irresponsible in our thinking. Like, you know, our conditioning has led us to believe all sorts of information and follow all sorts of thought trains. And there's much that's been said around misinformation and disinformation. So I don't want to go on a tangent there. But one place it hasn't one place it's shown us up to be smart is, I think that people, and I see this a lot sort of in the influencer space, generally customers can smell a rat very quickly. They can smell an insincere representation or engagement very quickly. So as dumb as we've been in terms of news and information, we've been kind of smart in terms of the integrity behind brand-based relationships. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why that seems to be a place where the consumer audience is really astute. But what it does mean is that, you know, that clearly and obviously is not an approach that's paying dividends for either party, for the brand or for the influencer. So yeah, I think it's harder work to do that. And it's harder work to be selective, and it's difficult to know what to say no to. But it was the same for us when we started Cerebra in 2006. We had to very quickly decide what types of clients we wanted to work with and didn't want to work with. We had to say no to some opportunities, not just because they weren't commercially viable, but because they weren't values viable. You know, we had a very tough decision firing one of the big four banks, which at that time was paying us a ridiculously profitable retainer, but because our values weren't in line. We may or may not have had an opportunity with another one of the big four banks at the time, but that's immaterial. Let's focus on the principles. And you know, I just think that what you say no to defines you much better than what you say yes to. And what you say no to is going to be determined almost exclusively by what you deem to be important and true. And that is the essence, the DNA of your values. And I don't think that influencers are considering their values more important than their audience.
So then that actually brings up something that I'm very passionate about as well, is having better regulation in the influence marketing space. I am one of those culprits who will easily call out a brand or an influencer for not
being transparent with their audiences. I just think even though audiences are amazing, and like you say, we saw it in the last couple of weeks in a couple of campaigns where just the population was lambasting brands and influencers alike for not being transparent, for not being a good fit. But do you not think that if there are better regulation, that we'll see less and less of this? And also it will kind of go a long way to kind of legitimize the channel a bit further and people not having this anti-influencer kind of attitude that we sometimes get. And that for us is then a bigger, if you say, education job to just show people, but it does work if you do it the right way, if you align the right influencers with the right brands and you kind of give them that creative freedom. I would just love to see more regulation around it instead of having the ARB being quite reactive to things. You have to lodge a complaint, you can't be anonymous, and then they kind of rule. But other than that, there's no policing, and it's a slap on the wrist at the end of the day. All they do is tell you, please take down the content. It's more of a reputational risk. Mm. But I would love to see that kind of coming more to the fore in South Africa.
Yeah, I must confess, my understanding of the existing regulatory frameworks and compliance frameworks is infantile. I don't have a good sense of what's in place at the moment. Look, I want to say yes. I want to say, yeah, that'll solve everything, but I also know how people work. And it appears that the more structure and more rules you give marketers, the more they attempt to break them. I'm more of a carrot than a stick person. I think that what will really shift the space is if kind of positively reinforced behavior becomes the norm. And that's, again, it's up to the, but you know, I understand that as I'm saying this, how naive I sound, because it just typically doesn't happen. I don't think it can be a bad thing, but I think it's got to be, you know, it's got to allow for a lot of creative freedom. It's got to allow for people to still invent and discover new ways of building these relationships and creating new opportunities. If you get too prescriptive, that can also kill the opportunity entirely, and we wouldn't want to see that happen. I think that it would feel and look very differently if social networks felt and looked very differently, but I mean, this is my bugbear right now, so it's obviously an axe I'm going to grind a lot. Yeah, so, you know, I'm like, oh, I wish it could be different. But that is what it is. And that I don't think is going to change anytime soon. So, look, I think this is a very interesting time for the industry. I think there is a lot of scrutiny on these platforms. There is a lot of political influence all over the show. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in terms of personal data, in terms of advertising, and in terms of governance over the next 2 years, I guess. I think there will be changes. I think there will be some consolidation. I think I'm getting the sense that while there's been some stagnation in terms of innovation in the social networking space, that we might see some new upstarts springing up in the next couple of years that might, you know, change or challenge the incumbents, and that might be interesting. We haven't really seen anything interesting happen since sort of like 2007, 2008. So it's ripe for disruption. And yeah, I for one am very excited about the possibilities of that. But yeah, there's a lot to be fixed. And I guess the decisions, it's a little bit like doping in sport, right? Like kind of everybody does it. So, and everybody talks about it and everybody says it should be regulated, but still everybody does it. And if you don't do it, great. You're a principled person, but you also lose races. So it's really tough to manage that dynamic. And while what we're talking about doesn't necessarily correlate to performance like it would in sport, it still is a predominant dysfunction and needs to be addressed in some way, shape, or form. So yeah, do you make doping legal for everyone and then level the playing fields, or do you prevent people from doping and hope that they, you know, it's one of those, it's the age old dilemma.
Yeah. Look, I'm all for, like, I don't want it to be regulated to the point where you've got, like, a list of prescriptions.
No, sure.
The only thing they're asking people or influencers and brands to enforce is just add that this is being sponsored. You are an ambassador. This was a gift. This is an ad. The rest is up to you. Like, happy days. Go for it. I just think it's really important that people who aren't necessarily in our industry kind of know when an influencer is being paid to say something. which is really, really important.
I mean, this is what blows me away, right? Like, and here I'm not, I'm going to sound sanctimonious and I'm going to apologize up front. I'm sorry, not sorry. But I mean, I remember like early days of Twitter, like 2009, whatever. If I was talking about a project that we were doing with a client, I would disclaim that. I would say this is a project that we're doing, or I got to play with the new Galaxy Tab, and please do note that Samsung is a client, but I still think that this is amazing for these reasons. And
there you go.
And I would think that if you're a person that has a smidgen of integrity and self-respect, you would do that, because surely that builds credibility. Surely that makes your voice more authoritative, more trustworthy, more reliable in the mix. I mean, I just can't see how that wouldn't be the case and how you wouldn't understand that. But again, I suppose if everybody's doping, then it's easier to dope.
You know? No, but this is exactly what my point is as well. If you are an influencer and these great brands, or you've aligned with an amazing brand that you love and that you just, everything makes sense, why wouldn't you want to shout from the rooftops that I'm working with this freaking amazing brand? And it does build credibility. All the studies have shown over the last 2 years that no audiences mind if there's a hashtag ad or hashtag sponsored. They're actually proud of their influencers. And if it still adds value to them and it's aligned, they don't care. They actually just think, geez, this person is doing amazingly well. So I don't understand it either. That's just me.
Yeah. And the irony of it is just how it diminishes any real influence that you have, any real substance that you have. You know, your identity becomes so fragmented by, you know, in terms of whoever is throwing something free at you at any given point in time. It's just, it's no wonder it's an industry, and forgive me, but here comes my little spicy take. It seems characterized by a whole bunch of people that are diametrically opposed to the way they appear online. Like, they're devastatingly unhappy. They're overworked and underpaid. They are depressed and anxious. And it's because they're like, you're constantly foregoing your own identity and your own substance. You're basically selling tiny pieces of your soul with every post. And I'm like, that's not going to work long term.
And I think that is busy changing, and I hope it continues to do so, because I think people have figured that out, and they've also figured out that they should find a niche that they're so passionate about and that they actually love, because that's what's going to be the long game. We know that a lot of these influencers who are huge now and huge followings and also are influential, they've built those audiences over years, 5-6 years. And if you're not passionate about what you do or what you're talking about, you're going to be in and out of the game in a year or two. And then it's really of no consequence, really.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. The niche is where the power is. The niche is where money is. I firmly believe that. And if you are in any shape or form, you know, kind of, like most people I know who have like got a set of interests that they care deeply about, there is a way to work hard enough to find your groove in that space.
Absolutely.
It's a different kind of hard work.
No, absolutely. So then this birds the question. There's so many articles out at the moment, and over the last, I think since the pandemic started, they've just been flooding my inbox about that this influencer marketing bubble is dying. It's going to burst soon. I would love to know your opinion on this.
Perhaps if we're talking exclusively about human billboards, maybe the appeal, novelty, and sustainability of that's in question. But influence as a channel, connecting more intentionally with customers on a shared value basis, building long-term relationships with customers who are potentially even already part of your database that have significant or recognizable influence, jeepers, that's still an unmined opportunity. So if it's influence in the shallowest term, yeah, I guess maybe that bubble has burst. If it's influence in terms of what we're talking about, I don't think we're at the tip of the iceberg yet.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. And I am so excited you said that because I just see it's such a young channel, especially in South Africa even. It's just constantly evolving. And I think we are starting to delve deeper and deeper into what it means and also in ways of tools and reporting what we can provide to clients who's a bit skeptical. We can show them that we can measure different metrics. We can show them how it contributes to their KPIs internally. So it's not just, like you say, this billboard. It's actually mining that data, making sure we're speaking to the right audiences. And it's just delivering that message to an already opted-in audience that's there for that.
Good. We're aligned. Virtual high five.
Virtual high five. I know earlier you spoke about this omni-channel that we are entering into the marketing world, which I'm a huge fan of. Does that, in your mind, include traditional marketing or the traditional advertising? Does that in any shape or form kind of feeds into what we call our new media, so our digital influencer, etc.?
Totally does. Totally does. I mean, I was chatting to a gentleman who's launching a new wellness sort of biohacking startup, and we were talking about how he's invested an enormous amount of energy in digital content and digital marketing and advertising and looking to get into the influencer space as well. And we were talking about what you and I have discussed, this notion of, do we know whether it's working or not? And can we evaluate the efficacy of that spend based on, you know, the decisions people are making or not making based on our efforts? Yeah. And I'm like, you might find out that the most critical moment in a person's journey is at a particular stop street in a particular suburb receiving a flyer. Like, if we have to be realistic about the fact that meeting a person in the moment of most need and where they're questioning something is got very little to do with the type of channel we're talking about. If you start with the channel and work backwards, you've already made a mistake, right? Nobody has to be on Instagram. Nobody has to be on Twitter. Nobody has to have a website even. You have those things because they work in terms of fulfilling on the goals that you have set out to achieve. Some of the most effective brands in the world, some of the brands that are the most desirable, have got very minuscule and poorly administrated digital channels, which in fact, in a weird way, almost makes them more desirable and make it really difficult for you to get to, but the product speaks for itself. It's that, you know, so I think we've got to be very careful that we just assume all of these things are like default must-haves and we should spend on. You need to know why and how people are buying from you and when and, you know, what their mindset is. And yes, for a very long time, Google dominated that because I guess we were all, you know, sort of very excited about the fact that we could ask Google questions and get answers. And we were astonished when ads appeared that, you know, kind of answered the very question that we were asking Google at that particular point in time. But I don't know when last you opened google.com and typed in a search phrase. Like, we just don't, the way of our behaviors are changing radically, right? Our filters are changing radically. Our search behavior is changing radically. We have to think differently about reaching clients in the most, and making sure that whatever channel we are using, if it's a deck of colorful flyers or the most advanced AI-based, you know, programmatic marketing, and you know, available to us now, regardless of which thing we're doing, they're speaking to each other. We're speaking with the same voice. It's integrated. It feels like you're dealing with the same brand, you know. So those are the things that I think are still big opportunities for us to improve on.
No, absolutely. And to your point, is figuring out, obviously, where your target market kind of consumes media. And then you have to have several touch points. There's no way that someone's going to see something once. And unless that is what they need at that point, they're not going to buy it. They're going to see it on their social media. Then they're going to be driving to work. They're going to maybe see a billboard. Then they're going to be at work and reading an online article and see a banner. Then they might, like you say, stop at a stop street and get a flyer. And then only will they go, oh, wow, maybe I should check this out. And then maybe they'll go into Google and type and find out more about it. Precisely. So it really is about that omnichannel. And very important what you said is that it all speaks with the same voice and the same key messaging. Otherwise, it is lost.
Yep, that's the challenge.
It is a huge challenge. I mean, you come from agency background. When last did you see a couple of agencies from different disciplines sit around and play nice?
Yeah, sure. There's been that constant interplay between the idea of being a one-stop integrated shop and being like specialist, right? Yeah. And I always erred on the side of wanting to be a specialist. I'm not saying that's the answer, but our inability either as one-stop shops to offer an equivalent standard or quality of offering as the independent shops or as independent shops to be able to collaborate together has only served to damage the industry and the client's level of trust about what we do. And then we still complain that, consultants are starting to eat our lunch. Well, we could have done better.
Yeah.
The only reason you lose business is because you can't fulfill on the need that you promised you would fulfill on. So, don't be bitter, be better.
No, exactly. And I think it is getting better. I think agencies and consultants are starting to understand that. And so are brands. So let's hope the way of the future.
Yeah, I feel like I was like super grumpy there. Sorry about that.
Not at all.
Yeah.
I think everyone coming from an agency background, we're all grumpy about that.
Slightly jaded.
Oh, yeah. So, Mike, what industry trends or trend are you maybe most excited about at the moment or for 2021?
Yeah, I think I touched on that briefly. And in that, I think the social network incumbents are ripe for disruption. And whether that means that they change their own models or way of being or payment mechanisms or whatever it might be, or we see upstarts that start to force them to think very differently about their value proposition. Either way, I think that's an exciting prospect for the future. Other than that, I'm not thinking a hell of a lot about kind of general marketing trends, other than to acknowledge that I think brands are having to be far more intentional in the current climate. And I think that's showing up in organizations that, kind of have already done a great job, but just been amplified. And those that have struggled to do that for a long time are being diminished. But yeah, I'm excited to see what happens in the social network realm over the next couple of years.
Everyone is. I think we're on that cusp of everything just kind of changing a bit for the better. We've already seen, even on Instagram, that people aren't interested on that highly polished kind of curated content anymore. People want to see the real stuff because that's what they can relate to and it makes them feel better and it makes them feel normal, I suppose.
One certainly hopes, huh?
Yeah. So for our last question, Mike, is please can you give our listeners your top three tips when they consider a digital marketing campaign?
Sure. So I guess the first tip would be very explicit about your intentions, whether that's the objective that you're working towards, the metric that you decide is going to determine success, but know what it is that you're working towards and make sure you, the client, you, the agency are on the same page about that. You're speaking the same language about that. The second thing I think I'd talk about is think about values as a meeting point between you and the audience rather than demographics. You might be excluding a whole portion of your audience that is very valuable to you because you're not thinking through that lens. And then the third thing is, I think, look to invest in quality engagements from an influencer perspective rather than quantity. Stop thinking about audience sizes and start thinking about audience efficacy. Obviously this relates specifically to the influencer space, but I think brands are going to experience a whole new dimension of value when they start engaging with influencers on the basis of values and quality and integrity rather than just how many people might see the content.
That's great, great tips. And we also always say to clients, please don't look at follow accounts. Let's just look at the things that aren't vanity metrics and see how their values align, see how their audiences respond to the type of content you want to do and the messaging. It's so much more important to reach 20 people that's really going to listen to this influencer than 2,000 people who are just going to eye roll, I suppose.
100%. Yeah. Did behavior change is the question, right?
Exactly. So, Mike, before we let you go, where can listeners connect with you online if they want to know more about you and the exciting things that you get up to?
I'm available on Twitter and LinkedIn at Mike Stopforth. I've got a website that kind of is a meeting point for all of these things. It's MikeStopforth.com and a podcast just like you, called the One-Eyed Man podcast, which talks about leadership in technology and impact. And yeah, that about covers it, I think.
Absolutely. And I follow you on all of them and I listen to your podcast and I think you are amazing. So keep doing what you're doing. So just thanks again for joining us today. I really, really enjoyed our chat and I think you've given us a lot to think about.
Thank you for the opportunity and thanks to your listeners.
It's a big pleasure. Goodbye, Mike.
Bye-bye.